Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington. Ahead, reaction to the reported North Korean launching of another missile. Discouraging reports about Syrian peace negotiations. The number of teen pregnancies in the United States is recorded dropping. And researchers find music may help infants learn language and speech.
We engage the babies through movement, so like tapping their feet and bouncing them and helping them shake maracas and all that.
It's right here on the Voice of America. North Korea appears to have test-fired another intermediate-range missile. Joining me in the studio is VOA Steve Miller with an update, and he has a glimpse at the broader perspective, and he's been in the region for a long time, and we want to welcome you here, Steve, to our studio.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so this is the second intermediate-range missile test in just about as many weeks, and both times these tests have failed. Now, with something of this nature occurring with such regularity, one wonders what those who actually watch these events quite closely think, you know, when they wake up in the morning and see the news.
A lot of times you're not overly surprised when you see this now from North Korea. Can't say that there was a lot of surprise.
You know, provocations is the word we use. At this point, it seems to be becoming so regular as to not even be shocking. But, of course, this word provocation that is frequently attached to them is one that I think is, in a lot of ways, kind of losing its cachet. We're no longer shocked.
Right, so you heard two voices there. The first one was Jonathan Miller, East Asia Fellow with the East-West Institute, and the second one, Adam Cathcart, he's a professor at the University of Leeds who's actually studying Sino-NK relations. Now, with these latest missile tests, speculation of a fifth nuclear test just around the corner, and with China promising to fully enforce recent sanctions, a lingering question for many is simply why North Korea continues down this particular path. Cathcart says that it may actually be intentional.
We often wonder why are they doing this when it paints them into a corner. I think it's disastrous. It's very, very bad for Kim Jong-un and for any North Korean leader, I think, to be seen as too pro-Chinese.
But isn't China often considered a friend and an ally?
Well, yeah, that's the general school of thought, right? Miller actually tried to sum up Sino-NK relations in a single word.
I would say one word, obviously complicated in the sense that China's in a tough spot. They're in a very tough spot, becoming a bit of a severe nuisance for China, but it's a complicated relationship for sure.
And Cathcart puts things, well, a little bit differently.
Well, I think it's in a bit of a trough at the moment, or a valley, certainly not as low as it's ever been, but things are not looking particularly positive.
Next week, North Korea is holding its Workers' Party Congress, and it's pretty neat. This is the first time in 36 years they've had one of these things. What do the analysts think may happen?
Well, this is very interesting. So Jonathan Miller believes that the meeting is going to be all about Kim Jong-un, right? Essentially solidifying his grip on power through these latest series of tests and displays of force. Now, Adam Cathcart also agrees with that, but also notes that this could provide Kim Jong-un with a chance to demonstrate that he's not only in control and has the ability to purge people, but also shuffle the deck, so to speak. He also says there could actually be an improvement with Sino-NK relations if the officials that are put in place are younger, but also acknowledges that things could just as easily turn sour if weapon tests persist.
And I understand he might be speaking, and all eyes will be on him if he does.
True,
to see what he's saying. Okay, well, thank you, Steve, and I appreciate you joining us here for our next segment.
Oh, thank you.
And joining us at the anchor desk with more on the North Korean story is our social media reporter, Andrew Palcheski, who's been working hard out there. I saw him at the desk. Hey, what's going on?
Well, there's a lot of fun being made at the expense of North Korea and Kim Jong-un. There was a picture that I saw someone had tweeted out where Kim Jong-un is kind of raising his hand and said, the rocket went this high. So a lot of jokes being made, yeah. GIFs being shared of toy rockets gone awry, kind of crashing into the ground to make fun of North Korea.
And you can tell us, Steve, that if you were in North Korea doing that sort of stuff, you'd be in big trouble.
Absolutely.
Yes, these people are, you know, far away from the region, some of them, so they can kind of stand back and make these jokes without any kind of fears of reprisal.
And I was wondering, do you ever get or ever see any tweets that are actually from North Korean people, people in North Korea? Do they have access, Steve?
Not so much for people in North Korea, but at one time there was an official DPRK Twitter account. In fact, one person in Seoul, South Korea was actually sentenced to prison term for retweeting that because of a violation of South Korea's national security law, and that sentence was later suspended.
But they can shut those things down, can't they, the North Korean government?
If people try to open Twitter accounts, I mean, I don't know what their apparatus is to monitor those kind of things if they're shutting them down, but certainly they have some kind of apparatus to monitor if people are retweeting these things, certainly in South Korea, as that person, as they retweeted.
Okay. Well, there's another trending story, and this one is not on social media, but it's about social media, and you've been looking into that too.
Yes, it's a tale of two social media companies. We always kind of lump together Facebook and Twitter. But yesterday's earnings reports from both companies show that there is really a divergence between the two. Let's start with Facebook. Facebook beat earning estimates for the first quarter by about $120 million, revenue of $5.38 billion with a B, and 1.65 billion monthly active users. So they're doing quite well. Their stock shot up today to about $120 a share after this great earnings news that exceeded expectations. Twitter, on the other hand, revenue of $595 million, that's about $10 million less than expected. Their monthly active users, only 310 million, growing at a much slower rate. In fact, in previous months, they said they were losing monthly active users. And Twitter's really trying to find its voice and trying to find a way to monetize these tweets and incorporate ads and trying to make money off of that, something that Facebook has done a very good job of. And you also see in what these two companies are saying and how they're acting looking forward, that kind of tells the story as well. Facebook with Mark Zuckerberg is looking 10 years in the future. They want to do virtual reality. They want to do more 360-degree video. They want to do a lot of experiential kind of things with their messaging service. Twitter, on the other hand, is just trying to keep hemorrhaging people, trying to incorporate live streaming with Periscope, but they're really trying to struggle to try to find some way of success.
Well, we're really lucky because Steve is here, and our audience probably doesn't know, but Steve has over 40,000 Twitter fans. That's almost embarrassing.
No.
But how would you compare your use with Twitter? I mean, you're an expert at it, with some of the other social media.
Well, I think each has its own use. I mean, Twitter is great for news sharing and finding things happening at that moment because, right, your timeline just scrolls by so quickly. Whereas Facebook is essentially a way to curate content. You can go back and see your pictures from years ago. It's a way to talk with your quote-unquote friends, right, on Facebook and have that more personal connection.
Well, the way I've heard it described is that Twitter is kind of the news ticker and Facebook is like a scrapbook.
Well, that's a great way to explain it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we've been noticing, all three of us have been noticing in our usually all business news newsroom that there are a lot of little kids running around having
yes.
a great time screaming and yelling.
I see them outside our window here in the studio.
Yes.
I see them running all over the place. And
that's because we're not all being fired and a new younger generation replacing it. It's because it's National Bring Your Child to Work Day, and that's trending as well.
Yeah. We have hashtag Kids at Work, and it's sponsored by Hershey's, the candy bar company. I'm wondering if there's some kind of, you know,
link there.
Well, maybe the kids go to work and say, I want something from the vending machine. Oh, there's a Hershey's bar. You know, it's this idea of bringing your kids into work. It used to be take your daughter to work day. Now it's take your kids to work. So we're seeing a lot of people sharing that. AOL's Twitter account even had an employee's child take over their Twitter account. So that was a nice way to incorporate
that. Oh, that's awesome.
Them. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks, Steve. Thanks, Andrew. It's been fun. And you're all listening to VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
An international team of researchers has found that several nutritional supplements can enhance the effectiveness of antidepressant medications. Researchers from Australia's University of Melbourne and Harvard University say supplements such as omega-3 fish oils, vitamin D, and methylfolate were found to boost the effects of medications prescribed to treat those with clinical depression. The team's findings are based on an analysis of 40 worldwide clinical trials, along with a meticulous evaluation of evidence for treating severe depressive disorders with a combination of antidepressant medications and nutritional supplements. The Australian-American group, who outlined their findings in the American Journal of Psychiatry, say their research did not reveal any serious safety concerns from combining antidepressants with the supplements. But they did caution that patients should consult with their healthcare provider before doing so. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The UN Syria envoy says he plans to hold another round of peace talks next month, but called for a ceasefire to be revitalized before setting a date. Correspondent Luis Ramirez is following this story and joins us on the line. Welcome, Luis.
Hi, Susan.
Say, where do the Syria negotiations stand now?
Well, nobody is using the word collapse, but, they are saying they're barely hanging on. The talks have effectively stalled. The opposition largely walked out last week, and finally the mediator came on early Thursday morning and said that in order for these talks to go on, those who have supported them from the beginning, that's the United States and Russia, really need to get together and revive them. There is no agreement on the key issues. Of course, the main issue being should Bashar al-Assad remain in power, at least through a transitional government, or should he leave power altogether and have a transitional government take over? Russia, of course, supporting Mr. Assad, and the United States saying that he should go. Neither of the mediators aren't even talking about a date. They say they hope to get the talks restarted in May, but certainly there is no basis to back up that that hope for now. At least that was the tone when Staffan de Mistura, the UN mediator, spoke to reporters on Thursday morning.
What about the Russian sincerity about these talks?
Well, Russia has an interest in seeing the conflict resolved. Of course, it supported very effectively Assad's forces to the point where they were able to regain a great deal of territory. But at the same time, the conflict drags on, and we have, as we speak, violence worsening. Just Thursday morning, reports of airstrikes on a hospital run by the group Doctors Without Borders, the death toll climbing. Since Thursday alone, about 60 people reported killed in the largest city in Syria, which is Aleppo. That's where that hospital is. And that just caps a week of worsening violence. Some estimates have the number of dead at almost 200 since Friday.
Well, where does this go from here? Is it just desperation and giving up and walking away and let more and more people die?
The United States and Russia, of course, have been at the forefront of peace efforts. Secretary Kerry and his Russian counterpart Lavrov have been working pretty hard to try to keep this process on track. In fact, the talks have, at a high level, have been going on between the United States and Russia to get the peace process back on track. The pressure now being raised both by the worsening violence and by the reality in Geneva that the talks were not able to accomplish anything. And just to give you a sense of how far apart they are, there were no face-to-face meetings. These are still proximity talks where the groups would consult with each other. Then the groups would consult with the mediators, and then the mediators would go back and forth between the two camps, but no face-to-face meetings. That gives you an indication. This is the third round since January, and still not enough common ground to even sit at the same table.
Well, thank you very much, Luis. Appreciate you talking to us.
Thank you, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, U.S. teen pregnancy reported down, and music leading the way to speech. The Center for Disease Control reports there has been a drop in the number of teen pregnancies in the United States. Reporter Kevin Enix is following the story and joins us here in the studio. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you. Thanks. Glad to be here.
Oh, thank you. Well, share with us some of the details of this report.
Well, here's the headline. The headline is that births among Hispanic and Black teens have dropped by almost half in the past 10 years.
That's very impressive.
Yeah, since 2006. And what Bill Albert, I spoke to him, he's the chief program officer from the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy. He calls it one of the nation's great success stories of the past two decades, a drop like this.
Well, what brought it about?
Well, there's a number of reasons. Bill, Mr. Albert, says that there are a number of programs that are working very well, that have been implemented, community-specific programs. And he also points to some of these television shows, reality shows like Teen Moms and 16 and Pregnant. There have been research studies done that suggest these shows in and of themselves, which present a very sobering view of teenage pregnancy, have caused a lot of the drop.
Well, tell me about this community-specific business. What is that like? What is that all about? Maybe somebody overseas could use that as well.
Well, what Bill was telling me and what the CDC says is that a program that works in South Central Los Angeles isn't going to work necessarily in Oklahoma when you're trying to educate people about birth control and about the realities of teen pregnancy. So what the White House is doing and what the national agencies are doing is working very hard to find programs that work in specific communities and then putting support behind them. And what that shows is that it's working.
Well, so they actually take the culture that these teens are growing up in and apply it to those specific cases.
That's absolutely correct. What that has shown is that using an approach like this has shown results.
Well, perhaps you review for us, and I know many of us know this already, but in some places, teen pregnancy is not thought of as an unfortunate thing. But could you explain why here in the United States it's frowned upon?
Well, it's frowned upon because, according to the CDC, it costs us about $9 billion every year in negative health impacts, in the federal support that must be given to a lot of these young women who don't, in some cases, have any other place to take their children. So being frowned upon, and also we have a fairly Puritan view of sex before marriage in many places. So what this points to is that we're starting to make progress in that. We're starting to have the conversation about teen sex and teen pregnancy, and the fact that it can have very negative consequences is starting to sink in.
So it's a result also of some medical advances, maybe better pills, better birth control, and that sort of thing as well?
Absolutely. I think the easy availability of the morning after pill is certainly having an impact. So if someone does something stupid, they can get a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Well, thank you very much for stopping by the studio
today. Sure. Thanks for having me.
This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new is this increasing popularity of what is known as cosplay. Originating in Japan, cosplay involves people dressing up and acting like their favorite characters from films, comics, anime, and anywhere else superheroes tend to roam. It's some serious role play. Su Myat-No is a cosplayer.
We get to be our favorite character for one day. We get to act like them.
The 8th annual Myanmar Cosplay and Otaku Festival was held last week in Yangon, Burma. More than 200 cosplayers and about 1,000 fans swarmed the event that has seen its attendance increase tenfold over the past 3 years. But not everyone in Myanmar is a fan of cosplay. Ling Ong Cha is one of the event organizers.
The media, they comment very bad. Or like that, we destroy the Myanmar culture. So it's not a culture destroyer. It's just a hobby and realization for the young people.
For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossan.
Music may help infants learn language and speech. Researchers at the University of Washington's Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences used music like waltz and some old American favorites like Take Me Out to the Ball Game to find out more about the subject. VOA's Lori London spoke with Christina Chow, lead author of the study, and asked how they went about getting inside the minds of babies.
We basically have these nine-month-old babies come into the lab, and they were randomly assigned to either participate in this music group or they will be in the control group. So for the music group babies, the idea is that they came into the lab for 12 sessions of music play sessions. Each session was 15 minutes long. And in groups of two or three babies, we have them play with parents, and there's an experimenter guiding the parents who will help the babies through a set of activities to learn a particular music rhythm. So we help them learn we call the triple meter rhythm. So think of waltz in three. And it's a fairly difficult rhythm for babies at this age to process. That's why we picked it. And the idea is that we engage the babies through movements. So like tapping their feet and bouncing them and helping them shake maracas and all that. On the other hand, the control babies came to the lab for the same amount of sessions. And instead, they were just playing freely with toys and blocks. So after this whole play session period, that was about a month, and then we tested both groups of babies in how their brain process rhythmic information in both music and speech.
What did you find out?
We found that the babies in the music group had stronger brain responses to these disruptions in both music and speech rhythm in the auditory and prefrontal regions of the brain compared to babies in the control group. And so we think that participation in these play sessions with music improved these babies' ability to extract and detect patterns in sound. And this is a skill that's important both for processing music and speech rhythm.
Just to wrap this up, how is this a unique study?
It's unique in several ways. This is, I would say, the first that we know to have observed this crossover effect from music to speech at the earliest, as early as in infancy, 9 months of age. Kind of talking from another perspective, in infant learning speech sound, this is also the first time we're showing that having experience other than language experience in infancy can also help babies learn speech sound.
Christina Chow with the University of Washington's Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences. We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Russian Ministry of Justice has suspended the activities of the Mezhlis of the Crimean Tatar people, an institution registered with the Ukrainian government and operating in Ukrainian territory, putting it on the Russian government's list of extremist organizations. The Mezhlis has long been a representative body for the Crimean Tatar population. It has also served as an important independent voice in preserving their culture and protecting them from discrimination. State Department spokesperson John Kirby called on Russia to reverse the Ministry of Justice's recent decision to designate the Crimean Tatar Mezhlis as an extremist organization, and the decision by de facto authorities in Crimea to suspend this democratic institution. This move against the Mezhlis is the latest in a series of abuses perpetrated by the de facto authorities against those in Crimea who oppose the Russian occupation and attempted annexation, including Crimean Tatars and the members of other ethnic and religious minorities in Crimea. According to the latest State Department Human Rights Report, over the past year, Russian security services engaged in an extensive campaign of intimidation to suppress dissent and opposition to the occupation that employed kidnappings, disappearances, physical abuse, and deportations in Crimea. More broadly, Russian authorities engaged in a widespread campaign to suppress free speech and media in Crimea. They refused to register Crimean media and news organizations, preventing them from operating legally. Security services also detained and abused journalists and threatened them with prosecution for opposing the occupation. On April 19th, Russian authorities detained several journalists in Crimea and raided 5 offices of media outlets on the peninsula. One journalist, Mykola Semina, was detained for allegedly speaking out against Russia's occupation. This is the latest in a pattern of attempts to muzzle free speech in Crimea. The United States condemns the ongoing abuses in Crimea and again calls on Russia to end its occupation of Crimea. Sanctions related to Crimea will remain in place until Russia ends its occupation and returns the peninsula to Ukraine.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.